Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 117 with the title Infusing Empathy. And I have the absolute honor and privilege to welcome two guests today, Rita Elgato and Fiona Dawson. Rita and Fiona are collaborators in D&I and storytelling. And when I asked Rita to describe her superpower, she said it is her impossible dreams and the strength of other women. And when I asked Fiona, she said it is her ability to listen and make people feel heard. Hello, Fiona. Hello, Rita. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Hi, Joanne.
Hey. Well, as I said, this is my first venture into a threesome, I guess we can call this.
Hey.
This is my first polyamorous podcast, if you want. So let's see how it goes. Yeah. My show notes have gone out the window. We're off piece today, so anything can happen. So Rita, Fiona, infusing empathy. Who wants to go first?
I'll jump in first, I think. Are you wanting to know how we infuse empathy?
Go on, tell me your story. Yeah, tell me your story. You're a DEI storytelling. Tell us more about yourself.
So Rita and I realized that our superpowers naturally come together to be able to have a really powerful impact when it comes to corporate DEI work. So my background was in corporate diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging and accessibility. And then in 2010, I left the corporate environment and started off being an independent filmmaker. I have always recognized, of course, as many people do, the power of personal storytelling to be able to help build empathy and touch hearts and minds and like create change. So rather than lecturing people too much or, you know, criticizing people for not understanding or calling them haters, instead, my work kind of pulls away from that. And I create films that help people feel someone else's lived experience so that you can find things in common and therefore build empathy. That work that I started doing has kind of merged into a corporate space. And so last year, Rita and I were working on a really cool project together, making a short film for a client who has international operations. And we got to create a film together for this client to be able to use for internal distribution. And we realized that our skill set and our background was just such a nice marriage, as it were, where I'll let Rita talk about, you know, where she comes from. But we found that when we can put these two perspectives together, we have an opportunity to be able to work with corporations and corporate DEI programs in a pretty unique way and actually move corporations towards creating short form story content and focusing on values and lived experience in order to help employees internally understand one another despite their perceived differences and help them realize they actually have a lot more in common than we realize on the surface. So it's extremely rewarding work. We get to know people like at an emotional level and help them be more intimate with their personal storytelling than people are typically afforded within a corporate environment. So it's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Wow, I've got loads I want to talk about there. Rita, do you want to dovetail into your part of that equation?
Yeah, just to add to that, like I have been in the corporate HR, international corporate HR world for over 15 years. And I've gone independent early last year, and I noticed that D&I obviously has been a hot topic in the corporate environment even before that. And what I'm seeing is that we've not made enough progress. And sometimes it feels that we're going backwards in D&I and in our initiatives and approach. And, you know, I might even say that we're approaching it wrong. We're focusing on the wrong target. And I'm seeing a lot of businesses still in 2024 looking at diversity as the means, whereas I think we should be aiming to create an environment that's inclusive, equitable, accessible, that makes people feel they belong, which then would result in diversity. And whilst working in this project together with Fiona, we realized that, you know, we share the same values, we share the same view in how we see we would approach D&I in the corporate workplace. And I believe personal storytelling is exactly the means that companies can potentially use and build empathy and even compassion. So that's where we started collaborating.
I love the way you use the word feel. I'm a passionate advocate and believer that people feel included. They feel belonging through culture, through the environment. Yeah, I always say that inclusion is how you make people feel by how you treat them. So how we treat people in terms of how they fit into the organization. And I also agree with what you said there about the DEI is the input, the output. And I would describe it as positive people experiences. You know, you have a positive experience of working with me, working in the organization as a customer, as an employee, as a stakeholder, a shareholder, whatever it may be. It's about focusing on that outcome because we all want to be treated positively. And I think that's where we get caught up with the wokeism or the anti-woke stuff we get caught accused of. We're not trying to change the world. We just want to make everyone have a better experience in life and workplace. So that what you said there was really, really resonant. And Fiona, I mean, I've been both sides of the camera. Yeah, I do a lot of professional speaking, a lot of stuff in corporates. I even took part in a Channel 4 UK documentary a few years ago as well. So I'm used to having people sticking a lens in front of me and saying, how do you feel? And it's kind of awesome. It's a tough gig sometimes, isn't it? Building that trust.
Yeah. No, it is. And like and also for your audience, I'll explain where I am in the world because my accent is very British. So I'm aware of Channel 4, but I have not lived in the UK since 1998. And I lived and volunteered in Bangladesh for 6.5 months. I was in Portugal for a year. And then I ended up in Houston, Texas in the year 2000. So I've lived in the US now for 24 years, 11 and a half years in Houston, moved to New York, 9 total in New York and DC, and then back to Texas. So in my filmmaking work and capacity, I didn't go to film school. I just literally quit my job to make my dreams come true. And there you go. And I had the good fortune of connecting with people, and I'll specifically name like Gabe Silverman and Jamie Coughlin of Side by Side Studios. They collaborated with me on the Transmilitary project that I started in 2012, where we were sharing stories of active duty transgender service members in order to raise awareness that they were still banned from the US military. And that project lasted around 8 years or so. And so it was through that experience of working with Gabe and Jamie that I learned some of the practical aspects of filmmaking. So I've somehow become a film director, but I love being on camera as well, like you, Joanne. Like, I love hosting stuff. Like, I'm working on an unscripted show that I host. But I think that when it comes to creating a space for people to feel comfortable sharing how they feel, of course, the foundation of that is trust. And I had to learn, but also I think that I know my personality is that I do create a place where people can feel vulnerable because I am willing to be vulnerable too. Like, I'm willing to share parts of me. And I think that when we do that, it can be symbiotic. It's like a dance. Like, I love interviewing people because I love forgetting that the cameras are around, the lights are around, and it's just me and that one, or sometimes two people that you're interviewing. But it's like a dance, and you're connecting with the eyes, and like you just allow that person and elicit their story. And you know, I'll share, you know, parts of me too. And it's like an exchange. You know, I don't think you can expect someone just to pour their heart out if you're not willing to pour your heart out too. And of course, I have to create space where I'm not taking over. It's not too much of me. But somebody who's creating an environment, somebody who's creating an environment for somebody else to share has to be able to share themselves as well. And that's what I found in this work, you know, and have now like nearly 14 years of making films. And it's very, very powerful. And I think that you see the audience's reaction afterwards. And like with the transmilitary work, we had the short film on the New York Times and then the feature documentary premiered at South by Southwest. And so I went to a lot of different film festivals. And after watching those films, like the number of people in the audience that will come up to you afterwards and thank you for doing the work and thank you for sharing the stories. And I had so many people who privately came out to me after watching the film. So you, like you're in a theater and like you're the film director and they're coming up to meet you. And there were several people throughout the year of touring with that film that would kind of take me aside and whisper that, you know, they're trans and they're early in their transition and no one really knows. And thank you so much for sharing these stories because it helps me see that I can be out, like I can be myself. And I, you know, our characters as they were, you know, who are real people, they, their stories inspired other people and helped other people feel less alone. So it's really awesome to now like take that experience of being an independent filmmaker and take it into corporations, because most people go to a corporation or go to some business for their job and they spend more time there than they do at home. And so why would we not take this work into a business where people are? You know, I want to affect change. And so I've got to take it to where people are the majority of the time. And it's just a really beautiful experience.
I've got so much I want to dive into there, but let's let Rita chip in first before we come back.
Yeah, to just add to Fiona's words, I mean, corporate workspace is such an amazing place where personal storytelling can work in two ways. It can be educative, but not in like telling what people to do, but, you know, using empathy and, you know, using personal stories to share how people, you know, feel in a workplace. And there are a lot of businesses out there who are very inclusive, you know, who are very accessible, you know, people feel they belong, and it gives them the opportunity to show it to other people inside and outside of their company, who I think, you know, you could benefit more from using personal storytelling. And on the other side, I think it helps businesses who are very early in their inclusive journey to learn more about, you know, how they could make it more inclusive. And Fiona is amazing at that. Like, I mean, my surname literally means listener, but I'm not a listener. I'm not really good at that. And I sat through interviews with Fiona, you know, listening in the background as the executive producer, and the safe space she creates is amazing. And it's truly, truly amazing to listen how she connects with the people she interviews and shares their stories.
Thank you, Rita.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a mutual virtual hug here. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So whereabouts in the world are you, Rita? Are you Texas as well, or are you
No, I'm actually based in London, but I'm originally Hungarian, so obviously people can hear my accent. Some people can even guess that I have an Eastern European accent, but I've lived in the UK for about 12 years and a year and a half in between in India. But I've spent almost a third of my life in the UK so far. So I'm based in London.
So we're all kind of displaced because I was originally born in Singapore. I didn't live there for long, but I was originally born in Singapore. So I guess I'm not living in my country of birth either. Yeah. have that shared sort of lived experience. I think it's remarkable that you've both fallen into what you do and together. Because I'm conscious about the fact that, you know, Fiona, you live in Texas, which isn't, from an outsider's perspective, isn't the most tolerant of administrations within the state. And Rita, your Hungarian background, we can all see a lot of challenges emanating from Hungary and certain Eastern European countries and the attitudes of old. So Do you find that you're having an uphill battle to push against maybe the infrastructure where you're based, or do you find it's quite an open door that you're working
with?
I want me to go first. Go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think the D&I space is an uphill battle. Like, you know, we've all seen that D&I budgets are being cut, and it's kind of, you know, the same uphill battle as in a lot of other things, but in the corporate world. But we're definitely seeing fellow practitioners and D&I colleagues telling us, you know, how they would love to do a number of things, but they aren't able to because, you know, when budgets are tight, unfortunately, D&I budgets are the first to be cut, even within the people budget. And it's really sad to see, but at the same time, I think it gives us more power to Fiona and to myself to push back and to maybe educate leaders that the way they've been thinking about D&I is not the right approach. And because I think a lot of leaders expected initiatives to bring immediate results, and it did not happen because the approach has been wrong, and it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And I think that's where the early learnings, you know, for fellow D&I practitioners came from, when, you know, we all started doing bits and pieces and we realized, you know, hang on, this isn't going to bring meaningful change. And now we're facing this challenge that I think a lot of us now know how we would approach it or how we should approach it, but now we don't have the budget. So it's a bit of a catch-22 situation where I think we are finding our way to make this work in the corporate environment, but now a lot of the in-house D&I practitioners don't have the budget. So yeah, definitely an uphill battle.
Yeah, we see. I mean, I see a lot of rhetoric in the, obviously I'm UK based at the moment, a lot of rhetoric in the UK press around from the government talking about D&I initiatives are a waste of money. They haven't delivered the benefits, all this kind of pushback. And I think even here, the same from the US in certain, you know, government institutions, they're pushing back against EDI, D&I training. And I think you both made the point that people went into it without the right expectations, without the right momentum and longevity. They're not tracking that. They're seeing D&I as an overhead, which is why we're seeing budget cuts. We're not seeing D&I as an investment in the same way we see maybe leadership development or the people space. It's always still seen as an investment often. So I think we need to move that narrative from seeing D&I as a cost and a hassle and a wokeness and a sojourn we have to sort of fight our way through, to actually leveraging productivity, happiness, discretionary effort, reduced hiring costs, reduced turnover, reduced onboarding, all these kind of immediate, which we can quote Gartner and McKinsey and all these stats, the cows come home. But a lot of companies just don't get it right, do they? And I think the storytelling you're approaching it with, for me, is key. Listening to the impact you can have with people's lives. And when you're saying that, Fiona, with people coming up to you afterwards having experienced the content you're producing, and with a tear in their eye, with the story to tell back to you, that must be immensely empowering.
Yeah, it is. Like, just, oh my gosh, hearing you say those words, I've now got chills and getting emotional just thinking about it, because it is. And you can't separate that experience from a workplace as well. Like, I think for traditionally, you know, a workplace has been where, you know, leave your personal life at home, leave your feelings at home, leave everything else at home, work, go to work, you know, be a machine at work, and then go back home. And like, we know that doesn't exist anymore. You know, that model of the workplace, you know, is gone, is vanished. And I think, like, going back to your point about where we are in the world, you know, I'm in Austin, Texas, so it's the capital of Texas. I actually happen to be in a WeWork that's on Congress, and I can see the state capitol from this building. And so I am faced with the politicians in Texas on a daily basis. And I personally love being in this place in the world, because I feel there is so much great work to be done. I do work with Equality Texas. Like, that's the one, not the nonprofit that my company Freeline Productions does work for. And we're helping educate, entertain, and inspire through personal storytelling with Equality Texas. And I think that talking about both in the UK and in the US and states across the US, how like DEI is being cancelled and gotten rid of. I personally believe it's not going away. It's just shifting, and it's going to probably be labeled something else. But when you're talking about people development and leadership, you can't have a leadership training if you don't talk about the diversification of your workforce. Like from stats here in the US, like 1 in 5 Gen Z identifies as LGBT. You know, the future is very queer. Not only here in the US is it very queer, you know, white people by numbers are going to be less than 50%. I mean, and that's just a fact, but we're all like spiritual beings having a human experience. We just happen to be put into different human meats, you know? So it's like, if you want to be a leader, you're going to have to educate yourself on what these humans are going to look like and behave like and be culturally raised in order to have a successful workforce, in order to have a successful business. And, you know, Rita and I know, like, studies show that when you have an inclusive environment, it's better for your bottom line. Like, we've known that for a long time. But instead of going, oh, it's better for the bottom line, therefore I need to hire this many, you know, black people, this many gay people, you know, this many people living with disability, and if I get them all together in a room, then we're going to make lots of money. And of course, we know that's rubbish. It doesn't work like that. Like, you've got to be able to be less afraid of bringing vulnerability, kindness, courage, empathy, joy, fear, sadness, grief, all these things that we all experience. Let's talk about them at work as well. I mean, and that's when you start to create a space where people can be seen and heard. A lot of people say they don't like labels, and I can understand that, but labels help you find each other. You know, I'm a very out and proud bisexual, cisgender, immigrant woman living with a non-apparent disability. And I'm going to give those labels so that somebody who's also living with one of those identities knows that I can relate to potentially to their experience, and we can talk about it. And that's what I think we need to bring into that environment. So, you know, one more thing I'll say, and then I'll stop talking because I really feel like I'm going off in multiple angles. But I just think that we're living in a time of the universe, of the world, of society, where there are massive shifts happening. There's a big change, and change is extremely scary to lots of people. And so if us as DEI practitioners, storytellers, people who build empathy, if we can help carry people through change and help decrease that fear, then I think that, you know, we'll create places where everybody can be happy and live in joy.
I'm with you there. I mean, we should all be queer meat sacks. I think that's probably a good way to look at it, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Rita, Fiona talked about society. And I think it's super important to remind ourselves that corporations have the ability and power to influence broader changes in the society. And I think people in corporations, and especially people in leadership, tend to forget that, you know, everything starts somewhere, and big companies have that power. And leading by example is super important in businesses, because that's where we're able to make broader changes. And, you know, changing the society from the individual's perspective is a lot more difficult. But if you look at, you know, the big enterprises and the way they make changes in their policies that affect, you know, their employees, could have easily a broader impact on the society. So that's why I believe that we do have to focus on educating and helping corporations to really bring those changes and not just pay the lip service, because that's where we can then influence bigger changes, and not just, you know, in the UK or in the US, but in places like Hungary as well, or in, you know, other countries.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen examples where the power of the corporate voice, if you like, for want of a better word, corporate allyship. We've seen it in Florida with Disney. We've seen it with the bathroom bill in the US. where corporations basically pulled out, was it South Carolina, for a while, and just said, we're not going to operate here if you're going to have these discriminatory tactics. We've seen people putting pressure on Bermuda and places like that where ships are registered, where they ban gay marriage. So we've seen that going on. We've seen other regimes being, if you like, ostracized, Myanmar and places like that in the world where queer rights have been pushed back. But then we see governments such as the UK government and the potential next US government almost green lighting, anti-trans and anti-gay type rhetoric. And we need to stand up as a corporate nation, if you like, because my time in corporate life is very welcoming. It only becomes messy for me in pits of society influenced by the government sometimes. And I think that's the struggle. So Fiona, you wanted to dive in there.
I wanted to add something as well. And I totally agree that, businesses, corporations do have this opportunity to continue their leadership in this space. And when it comes to budgets, when a DEI budget is cut, really, I would love to see marketing teams jumping in. Marketing teams typically have much, much larger budgets than DEI. And I think that here in the US, where a few companies, particularly last year, were kind of in hot seats based upon their actions with DEI, if marketing and DEI were communicating really, in step together, then a lot of that, I think, could have been very different. And I think with the work that Rita and I do, when it comes to filmmaking, I personally would love to work with a marketing team and a DEI team, but the marketing team with a DEI perspective, because those budgets are going to be able to fund the kind of films that we're making and the animation that we're making. And it doesn't have to be labeled DEI. And I think people, marketing teams will spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on flashy ads and that kind of stuff. But for a smaller budget, you could make an authentic, independent film and have incredible impact. And I just think that there is so much opportunity that's out there. This is not like a desert.
No. Rita, I understand you work with a lot of startups and entrepreneurs building hopefully hyperscale businesses. They have the ideal opportunity to start with EDI, D&I, inclusive leadership at heart, but often they're founded by a tight-knit pair or small group of college leavers or whatever it may be. And it's often hard for them to bring other people into their mix in the early stages. So how do you encourage businesses like that to embrace the power of a broader demographic?
I mean, it's not easy, because when founders start their business and they try and make it work and they try and build a viable and long-term sustainable business, often the people part is important, but it's not the number one priority. They would hire people who will help them to get to that next stage, to achieve that goal. And in an ideal world, it would happen along with a long-term people strategy, where they are building a sustainable workplace from the get-go. But to be fair and honest, small businesses, struggle a lot at the very beginning. And I don't think D&I and sort of inclusion proactively comes into the picture before they reach 60, 70 employees. And I don't blame them, because they have so many things to be worried about. And we don't get to see those businesses that don't even make it to this stage. And a lot of them don't. But there's definitely an opportunity. And not by, they don't need to hire a D&I practitioner or a senior people leader from the get-go. But there's definitely opportunities for those founders and leaders early on to educate themselves and to be conscious and mindful about how they are going to build an inclusive workplace. And what I'm hearing and seeing the most is oftentimes leaders don't know where to start. And that's another problem, right? Like, okay, I want to build an inclusive workplace, but where do I start? And that's what makes it difficult. And I think us as fractional people leaders like myself, you know, have this opportunity to support these founders and build that workplace. But it's unfortunately in a very, you know, difficult business environment, it's not an immediate priority.
Yeah, I've experienced very similar in some of the work I've been doing. It's a shame because what we're effectively saying is D&I isn't important until I can afford it. Whereas we should be saying D&I should be integral to the founder's mindset at the very early stages, because you can't afford not to do it. You know, when we talk about these businesses struggling or not growing or not succeeding, is it because they haven't got that diversity of mindset? They're living in an echo chamber. They need to broaden their horizons on that.
Yeah, and I think it starts with this, you know, small, simple things. And a lot of these founders might still think, you know, with numbers in their head, with diversity in their heads. And how many times we heard, oh, we don't want quotas. And it's not what they should start with. If you think about inclusion, you start with policies, right? Look at all your policies. How inclusive are they? Are they allowing your employees to be their true themselves? To be their true themselves, and are they allowing them to feel belonging? And is your workplace accessible? So there are some very easy, you know, starting points to look at. And then secondly, it's talking to your people, listening to your people. And I've had an amazing colleague who taught us, you know, don't fall for the solution, fall for the problem. And I've seen that a lot, especially in the HR world, and in the D&I world as well, when those leaders are like, oh, I've got this great idea, let's implement this. But is that really a problem in your business? Do you really need that? Whilst, you know, going in a different direction where you ask your people, you know, what do they need? What would make them feel more included in your company? And there you go, you've got your actions. And so I think it's simple. It's just the approach where we put diversity away as the means and we focus on how do we make this place accessible, equitable, and inclusive.
Yeah, it's really hard, though, managing diverse groups of people. I mean, I'm the chair of a board of a professional association, and I've got 9 people with vastly different backgrounds, thinking styles, ages, genders, and perspectives. And it's really hard to chair that board sometimes where you're trying to allow everyone to have a voice, move things on, reach consensus, and, if you like, work with the disagreements or work with the differences of perspective to bring that harmony and togetherness where we make a decision that we'll all stand behind. It must be really hard, you know, as you say, in a startup environment where founders want to, you know, in quotes, get shit done and make things happen. And they've got all these people, they've got to start, I've got to be nice to them. I've got to be nice to them. I just want to get on with this. Is that some of the challenge there, Rita?
Yeah, but I think it's a challenge everywhere. But it's like, it's a sprint. It's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And so I think we need to approach it differently as well. Like, you know, do we want an immediate decision and a consensus, which, you know, might lead to some results? Or do we actually want to do something better, bigger? When, you know, in that case, we might want to spend more time to allow others to add their input and feel heard. And yeah, so I think it's a difficulty in any workplace meeting, whether it's a small emerging business or a large corporation. But I love working in those challenging environments because that's how I learn. And I think if we allow ourselves to be vulnerable in the sense that, you know, I don't know how to, let's say, moderate a meeting like that because there are so many different kinds of people in there, but I'm going to allow myself to be open to that experience and see how it goes, then we might actually get something more meaningful out of that. Maybe it takes a little bit longer, but it would definitely, I think, bring greater results.
Thank you. Fiona, you talked about getting marketing involved, and that really resonated because I'm thinking here, brand is owned by marketing. And when we talk about recruitment, we talk about employer value proposition, we're talking about recruitment marketing, we're talking about brand and culture have to figure very heavily in our marketing strategy and in our recruitment strategy. We're not going to recruit people who don't resonate with our brand. And what I tend to find is when people are going through the hiring process, the hiring manager or the hiring team have a disconnect of priorities with the corporate objective. They're trying to fill an empty chair. They're trying to get their project done. They're trying to make something happen. And they'll just go, oh, here's a CV. Let's hire them. Or yeah, I know somebody. And we all the best inclusive hiring practices go out the window because I've got a CV on my desk and they'll do. And for the priorities, you hire and velocity, cost to hire, and the experience. You can't have them all high. You've got to spend more money to get better experience or slow down. So I often see recruiters and hiring managers breaking away from the corporate objective. And what we really need as a practitioner, I always say, I need to leapfrog the hiring team and talk to comms, talk to marketing, talk to HR, talk to the DEI people, and get them to do a pincer movement on the hiring teams and say, okay, now we need to think about how we can hire more inclusively in a more contemporary hiring process than just the way we've always done it, which means we always end up hiring the people we've always hired. And that's not to say they're not the right people, but that we haven't had the choice to evaluate whether they're the best people.
Does correct.
That get us back into marketing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that with all of this, it's kind of breaking down as many silos as you can within an organization and ensuring that all of these different teams are communicating and collaborating together. And I think that comes down to creating a culture and an environment where that happens organically and starting off potentially with, you know, workspaces, whether people are physically at a building or whether they're online or whatever, be able to create, as Rita was saying, like an accessible environment physically and culturally in order, you know, for these conversations to happen. And I think if you want to take it back to marketing and the external comms, I think sharing content that is actually authentic and actually genuine and isn't just, you know, placating to an audience and, you know, somebody thinking, oh, you know, we want to, I'm going to use LGBT again because it's my world, but, you know, we want to hire more LGBTQA plus people. Therefore, you know, we're going to go sponsor this thing at Pride and we're going to create this ad with this, you know, cute couple of, you know, two genders and that way we're going to attract all the gays. And it's like, no, let's take a step back. And let's, you know, create content that has more of organic, authentic feel to it. And one of the tools that comes to mind is creating really strong ERGs, you know, employee resource groups or BRGs, business resource groups, and being able to engage the employees that you already have and make sure that those ERGs are also intersectional. So a lot of companies will have, you know, a Pride ERG, a veterans, people with disabilities. But all of us human beings, in addition to being meat sacks, we can use the analogy as icebergs, where only 10% of who we are might be, you know, apparent above the surface, but most of who we are is unapparent and beneath the surface. And you don't belong just to one ERG, you know, you've got multiple identities. And so I think that starting with those ERGs, you know, and then bringing people together in collaboration, making sure that marketing is including ERGs in their decision-making, you know, potentially start off with sharing stories of people that belong to ERGs and kind of like growing up from there. And to, you know, reiterate what Rita was saying about it being a marathon and not a sprint is like, always bear that in mind. Like just the smallest little actions can sow the seeds of really long-term significant change. And making sure that it is always authentic and always comes from heart. And it's not just checking a box because they think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, from a meat sack point of view, I don't think anyone's ever shouted out from the rooftop, we need to hire more trans people. But they we don't fit on their Noah's Ark sometimes. You know, the Noah's Ark has to have black people, white people, disabled people, disability. Maybe some gay people, maybe some lesbians. Well, we're not sure about bisexual people.
That's what about everyone. The bisexuals? Yeah, I mean, do you want to talk about the bisexuals? I mean, because that...
We can go there. Yeah, let's go there.
Well, I mean, for me, okay, so I'll share something. So when it comes to marketing, for example, say you're marketing to the queer community, and oftentimes when people are represented, like stock imagery, for example, like stock imagery could do with a bit of an injection of inclusion because they naturally go to, oh, let's put like two men, and I'm going to use like binary gender language. So we've got two, you know, cute guys that are going to be assumed to be gay, or we've got two women that are assumed to be lesbians. But how do you represent bisexuals in that imagery? Because any of those people could be bisexual. And if you have, you know, content where you've got somebody who is presenting, you know, female and male gender, and then another, you know, female gender, they're not necessarily straight. You know, one or both of them might be bisexual. And then if you want to really go further, like what about families that have more than two adults in their makeup? You know, where do they belong? Going back to Rita's policy, like here in the US, your healthcare is dependent upon your policy. What about families that, you know, are in polyamorous relationships, but you can only put one adult on your health insurance? You know, what do we do with that? So it's like constantly thinking about ways that our societies and our systems have set up barriers to access the basic things you need in order to take care of yourself and your family. So yeah, bisexuality, just for the record, let me let everyone understand, here in the United States, studies show that close to 60% of people who identify as lesbian, gay, and bisexual are bisexual. So we are not actually represented so much in media and filmmaking and TV. We've got all these stereotypes and tropes, and you know, I've got a book if anyone wants to understand more about it. That's a whole other podcast conversation, Joe.
Oh yeah, and I mean, just to chuck another grenade in there, the imagery you portrayed about this cute two men, these cute two women, they could be bisexual. Well, they could be non-binary, and they could all be trans as well.
Right?
And,
you know, exactly.
I spent 50 odd years of my life and no one knew what was on the inside. So yeah, exactly. We don't know, do we?
Exactly.
So we're judging people.
Most trans people also identify as bisexual. So realizing that there's a difference between biological sex, gender, and sexual orientation. And the US military is the world's largest employer of trans people. More than 15,000.
It's now a safe space to be out, to be supported. I still know a colonel in the Air Force who is trans. She gets a huge amounts of respect being a colonel, obviously, because people salute her and look up to her and they do as she says. So she gets far more respect and support being as part of the military community than she ever would in civilian life and out on the street. So it's well recognized under this administration, the military is hugely supportive, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you might be talking about Sherry Sawoski, who is retired Sherry Sawoski. No? Okay, no. Somebody else. No. So she's a retired colonel in the US military. So in fact, when trans people were still banned in the US military, they were still the US military was still actually the largest employer of trans people. So this isn't a new phenomenon. Trans people serve in the US military at twice the rate than cisgender or non-transgender people do. So we need to consider not just in the US, but the military is a workforce as well. And so how are militaries around the world providing an inclusive workforce? But I think the US military has long had a history of providing a space for trans people to be gainfully employed, to have community, to have a job that feels like you're part of something bigger than yourself, to access healthcare, to be able to get education, you know, all of those things that a cisgender person would like to have as well. So it's not new that the US military has been an environment where trans people have been able to serve. And yeah, it depends on different units. It depends upon your leadership on how you're treated. So like when the ban was still in effect, we found that there were many people who were out as trans and serving despite the ban, but because their leadership knew that the ban was wrong and they didn't care who you are, like what your gender is, do you have my back out where it matters? And that, you know, can you do your job? And so those people are allowed to serve. And then you'd find other units where there might be, you know, transphobia or a leader that did not get you as a trans person. And then that's when you're ostracized, you know, potentially kicked out. So I think that the military ban on trans people was outdated policy, going back to policy as well. It had nothing to do with the government. I mean, nothing to do with the government. Of course, it's part of the government entity. But it wasn't like it was outdated policy that needed updated. So it didn't really matter so much as to who was president. It was like, is the Department of Defense going to update their medical policies and include trans people to be able to serve? And finally, they did. And then there was a bit of a bump with one president from another, whatever. A
couple of executives and things, and just ignoring him for a while,
Yeah, exactly, because it was an executive order. Like, but now, you know, trans people can serve openly, but then you still need to update your policies to include intersex people. One in 100 people are born intersex, meaning they can have any combination of male and female sex tissue, chromosomes, and or hormones. And for the longest time, because of how your genitals look, you have been prohibited from serving in the US military, which is kind of ridiculous. And so it's like just being on top of, and that's where, again, like Rita and I think have this great collaboration where she's the expert on the policy in the HR. Like, I know enough to be dangerous on that. I'll be the storyteller. But marrying like updated policy with sharing someone's lived experience, and you can help build inclusion.
Rita, I can see you're dying to get back in there. Come on,
yeah.
Go for it.
No, I mean, I love that Fiona brought that up, because I recently read a report of a large global think consulting firm, and I was going like nuts about it, because they were talking about numbers, right? Like D&I report was just all numbers. And here's a simple solution for businesses. And, you know, just reflecting to, and Fiona said, you know, the US military just quote unquote needed to, you know, change their policy. Like, how about if companies and corporates start reporting their inclusion numbers and not their, you know, this is the number of this type of person we have, this is the number of this type of person. We're like, so let's talk about, you know, what's the gender pay gap in your business? How many and what kind of policies have been implemented to ensure, you know, equality, equity, inclusion, etc.? How do the career of members of underrepresented groups track, etc.? So, you know, let's not try and always talk about numbers, because it's almost like showing off, like, oh, look at how diverse we are, but are you truly inclusive? Here's a simple solution that any company could do. Ditch those reports and start talking about the type of policies that you implemented and the changes that you made, so that your people, wherever they come from, can feel themselves and included. And I think the US military is a good example of, you know, they could have talked about the numbers, but the true change came with a policy change.
Hmm. So we know, we've talked about it already today, that diversity, inclusion, equity, belonging, all these kind of things, the culture influences better outcomes for business. We know that. It's been out there for donkey's years. We know this. But what we've also got to recognize is the facts don't change people. We still drive too fast. We still eat too much red meat. We drink too much wine, even though these things are bad for us. We shouldn't do it. So for whatever reason, organizations aren't seeing these kind of work initiatives or strategic initiatives as being beneficial. You know, we talked about startups not seeing it as something they can afford in the early days. So how do we get businesses to start to do something? Because, as I say, the facts don't change people. We look at the World Economic Forum is talking around 160 odd years for gender equity in the workplace in the Western world. If you look at the globally, it's sort of 250 years, I think, when you include China and the Middle East and those sort of places. We have to encourage those with the power, those with the privilege, which, let's just pick a demographic out there. Let's just say it's straight white men, as an example, who often hold the power and privilege. How do we get them to enable the change? Because you can stand on the outside of the castle, banging the door down all you like, but unless someone's prepared to open it for you and welcome you in, how do we get people who hold those privileges to open the door, to have the conversation? They're scared. They don't know what to do. They're worried about being marginalised themselves.
You want to go first or you want me? I'm ready.
Go on then, go for it.
I'll just say two words and then I'll let you go. And by, like, I think it's simple, by building empathy and compassion. I think that's the very first step.
Yeah. And interrupting you? Okay, good. I think to build on what Rita said, like, and how you do that, is to help straight white men see themselves as diverse, because they are diverse. We all are diverse. It's not like straight white cisgender men versus everybody else. Like, that's the approach we've been taking, going back to all the numbers. Like, if you're, you know, we've created an environment where straight white cis men feel like they're left out of this conversation and they're shit. And we need to change that completely, because those straight white cis men also have multiple lived experiences that are beneath their surface that no one is talking about. And that doesn't mean that we're leaving all the marginalized people behind. What it means is that we're opening and we're making the table bigger for everybody to get there, you know, and help, like, that straight white cis man has faced adversity too. And now we've created an environment where if that man wants to share his story, he's feeling like he's been told to go sit in the corner and be quiet. And it's making it worse. Not only has he faced adversity, but maybe he has kids who have, or parents, or like other family members. And so that's why I think that we need to share everybody's story, including the straight white cis man. And those people who are in power and leadership, help give them the opportunity to be able to lead and include everybody without feeling like they're not included in that work. And the four steps that I feel that you go through is like self-awareness. So every human, if we could all increase our self-awareness, and if that straight white cis man can help increase his own self-awareness too, and then it's awareness of others. Because once you've worked on yourself, it's easier to understand and work with other people. And then it's courageous action and collaboration. But you're more likely to take courageous action and collaboration if you've done your own work. And to get a tiny little bit woo-woo here, is like elevating consciousness and realizing the spirituality that we all share, and that everything is going to be okay. Like, another analogy for you, you know, when you like go up on an aeroplane and like say down on the ground, as I know in the UK, it's raining a lot and you've got this cold cloud cover and you've got all this grotty weather on the bottom. But when you get on a plane and you go through those clouds, it's always, if it's the daytime, it's always gorgeous blue sky and gorgeous blue sunshine. And it's like all the joy and the prettiness that we see. And that joy and prettiness never disappears just because of the layer of cloud. And so just being mindful of that and remembering that we don't have to take ourselves and each other quite so seriously, like all these stories that we make up in our minds. And, you know, we're born to love, and that's what we should do in and outside of the workplace.
I love that analogy. I love the idea. It's, yeah, I flew to San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and you spend a lot of your time above the clouds or at night when you see some beautiful stars out there as well. So, yeah, I love that analogy. And I think what you're saying there is it's emotional intelligence 101, really, isn't it? The self-awareness, the awareness of others, connecting, collaborating. That's what we're talking about. So, Rita, what's your vision of the future? Yeah. Are we going to make a difference between us?
I hope so. I mean, I'd like to see the day when all companies have truly inclusive and diverse boards and senior leadership teams who will be the champion of inclusion and acceptance. Are we going to get there in the next decade? Maybe not, but I do believe that at some point, you know, we're going to get closer to that. And so I'm going to, you know, do everything in my power in order to truly build inclusion and equality in the world, which, you know, I think including more people and being more inclusive doesn't mean excluding others. And I believe, you know, we can do this work, build inclusion, by remaining still positive and being on that, you know, up above that blue sky. And no one needs to feel that, you know, they are under those gray clouds. So, yeah, I hope so.
I like that. we got to recognize we can't build inclusion by excluding and leaving people behind. This is a we thing. This is a together thing. It's a collaboration thing. I'm a great believer that EDI, D&I, whatever acronym you want to use, is a collaborative sport, not a competitive sport, because it's about combining our resources to everybody succeeds, not trying to succeed ahead of somebody else. So yeah, I love that. Fiona, come on, what's your vision here? Where's the world going?
I know we're going to get there because I'm seemingly positive, and hopefully it'll be before I'm 90 years old. So we'll see. But no, I do. I think that we are truly living in a very fascinating time in, I don't want to say history, but in time of the world. Like, I just think it's really cool that I think big systemic changes happening. I think it's for the betterment of societies, but it's extremely challenging to go through that. And like Rita said, like, I will do everything in this lifetime to do what I can to help build a world of equity. I know that I have been born with many privileges, and I see myself as called to use the privilege that I have to be able to help other people. And I see good. I think it's happening. It's going to be a bumpy road. It is a bumpy road, but absolutely.
Staying committed. And, you know, I think, you know, we look at some of the leadership models. One of the things is commitment to the objectives. Commitment is we need to have courageous conversations. We need to stand up for what we believe in, because there will be people who want to push back. And it's having that strength of character. I think the other thing we can do as consumers is we can vote with our pound or our dollar or our cent or whatever currency, and make sure we're amplifying businesses that support our own values and our own brand ethics. So even if we can't change the incumbents, we can make sure the next generation sprout the green shoots we want to see, and then the other organisations will wither on the vine and become less relevant. You know, those monolithic companies of the past. We've only got to see what's happened to the Twitter share price over the last year or so to realise that hate doesn't sell. There is people who will finance hate, but fundamentally it doesn't win. Hate never wins. Mm-hmm. We've just got to keep pushing that fight. Wow, for my first threesome, my currently amorous podcast here, polyromantic.
How was it for you?
it was fascinating. We're all in different countries and different time zones. Well, no, I suppose Rita and myself, we're in the same time zone, same country at the moment, but the electrons are flying around the world. So Rita, how do we get hold of you? How do we find out more about what you do?
I mean, I'm mostly on LinkedIn. People can find me on LinkedIn, and you know, I do have a website too, but usually LinkedIn is the easiest. Rita Hargato, although my surname is not easiest to remember, but yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm quite active there. And then, you know, Fiona and I are collaborating together on different things. So we often talk together on things, and yeah, so that's where I'm accessible at most.
Fabulous. Fiona, how about yourself? Fiona.
So on LinkedIn, Fiona like the princess, Dawson like Dawson's Creek. I think my LinkedIn URL is like Free Lion. So I'm easy to find there. And then the website freelionproductions.com, and we have a page for Rita and I's collaboration. So you can read about us there and find Rita there as well. And there's also a page of my filmography, so you can see an example of like the docs that I've done and the animation and that kind of stuff. So, and email fiona@freelionproductions.com.
Thank you so much, the pair of you. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.